Picture this, if you will. You're a primary care physician working at an outpatient clinic, and you're about to walk into the room of a 52-year-old female patient who you've known for years. After reviewing the chart, you recall that, about a year ago, you referred her to a nephrologist to evaluate her worsening kidney function. Her lab work shows that her kidney function's improving, but since her last visit, she's gained about 10 kilograms, and for the first time, her body mass index classifies her as clinically obese. She's noticed this as well, and additionally complains of unsightly stretch marks on her belly. You initially imagined that that's not so unusual, given her rapid increase in abdominal girth. But on physical exam, you're very surprised at the dramatic purplish appearance of the stretch marks, much more severe than you'd normally attribute to that degree of weight gain. On a hunch, you ask her what the nephrologist diagnosed as the exact cause of her worsening kidney function. She can't quite remember the exact diagnosis, some kind of nephritis maybe, but she says he prescribed her some pills to take and pulls out a bottle of prednisone from her purse. And welcome to Audio Bricks. I'm Arjun Iyer, bringing topics from endocrinology from our bricks to your ears. Man, it's been a while since I've been on the air with y'all. Did you miss me? Anyway, after completing this section, you'll be able to 1. Define Cushing syndrome by its classic endocrine abnormality. 2. Describe the most common clinical findings associated with Cushing syndrome. 3. List and describe the main causes of Cushing syndrome. 4. Explain how laboratory tests are used to diagnose Cushing syndrome and identify its underlying cause. And 5. Outline the treatment of the different forms of Cushing syndrome. Part 1. What is Cushing syndrome? Put simply, Cushing syndrome is a cluster of clinical features resulting from high blood levels of cortisol, whether the excess is from taking medications or from the body's own overproduction. If it's the patient's own body that's hypersecreting cortisol, you can further classify Cushing's as primary, or an increase in cortisol from a hyperfunctioning adrenal gland, or secondary, where a hyperfunctioning anterior pituitary stimulates the release of excess cortisol via adrenocorticotropic hormone, or ACTH. Fun fact, secondary hypercortisolism is actually a lot more common than primary, and because of that, it ended up being the first etiology of hypercortisolism discovered by Dr. Cushing. That's why you hear some folks refer to secondary hypercortisolism as Cushing's disease. But don't confuse the two. Cushing's syndrome is the overarching term for all causes of hypercortisolism. Anyone else sick of eponyms yet? Personally, I just like calling them primary and secondary hypercortisolism. It's the same naming convention used with most other endocrine disorders, so you're gonna have to get familiar with them anyway. And if you're not familiar with how hypothalamic pituitary axes work, I suggest you check that brick out. But this is where the simple stuff ends. Cortisol is a stress hormone with a wide range of effects, and as a result, Cushing syndrome also affects a ton of organ systems. Let's do a brief active review of cortisol's effects under physiologic conditions. First, how does cortisol affect the blood pressure? Cortisol maintains the blood pressure. It doesn't cause hypertension under normal circumstances. It simply potentiates alpha-1 receptors so that the sympathetic nervous system can successfully cause vasoconstriction. Next, is cortisol an overall anabolic or catabolic hormone? Cortisol is probably the most net catabolic hormone around. Under physiologic conditions, it helps maintain the serum glucose through glycogenolysis and gluconeogenesis, and increases other circulating macromolecules via lipolysis and proteolysis. And what's cortisol's effect on inflammation? Cortisol famously decreases the inflammatory response, limiting the sometimes enormous damage our own bodies can do to us through unregulated inflammation. And finally, what is cortisol's effect on bone metabolism? Cortisol is responsible for increasing bone resorption and decreasing bone deposition. In a physiologic context, cortisol is a necessary endocrine regulator that helps us battle external threats, and its presence in the human body is absolutely essential. However, chronic high levels of cortisol may cause harmful effects. Cortisol's effect on bone metabolism can lead to osteopenia and osteoporosis in excess. Hypercortisolism also causes poor wound healing through decreased fibroblast activity, and this can compromise the integrity of not only skin, but also the walls of blood vessels, leading to ecchymosis and easy bruising. Cortisol's broad anti-inflammatory properties can lead to suppression of the immune response in excess, and therefore leading to increased susceptibility to infection. Cortisol's potentiation of the sympathetic vasoconstrictors can contribute to hypertension. And finally, the catabolic effects of hypercortisolism commonly lead to chronically increased serum glucose, leading to a secondary form of diabetes. Now, that's a pretty wide range of seemingly disparate effects, and there's a few different mnemonics to help you remember them. For me, I like to give hormones like this a personality to help me remember all the effects. Cortisol's profile as a stress hormone reminds me of those gunners in med school who find every excuse to stress out about something minor, like, oh, getting a 90% on a test. Just like the high-strung gunners are known for their many emotional breakdowns, cortisol is known for macromolecule breakdown, or global catabolism. Gunners may come off as confident and self-important, but they're secretly sensitive with fragile egos. Cortisol, the gunner, causes structural fragility with weak bones, skin, and blood vessels. Like all good gunners, cortisol is always way more intense and stressed out than the situation warrants, so as a result, he's always running around with a sky-high blood pressure. And finally, the constant stress and sleep deprivation adversely affects cortisol, the gunner's health and immune system, and as a result, he's always getting sick. I'm sure you all know someone like this in your schools. Or maybe you're that student. But it'll probably be relatable enough to burn the profile of cortisol the high-strung gunner into your brains. Last note on physiology. While most of the abnormalities in Cushing syndrome are caused by high levels of cortisol itself, the steroid molecules are often promiscuous. No, that doesn't mean what you think it does. It just means that while cortisol mostly acts on glucocorticoid receptors, it also has some activity on other steroid receptors. Add the fact that cortisol synthesis is linked to the synthesis of androgens and aldosterone in the adrenal cortex, and you often see the effects of androgen and mineralocorticoid excess in Cushing syndrome. Part 2. What causes Cushing syndrome? Well, like our patient from the intro, Cushing syndrome is most often iatrogenic, meaning exogenously administered corticosteroid drugs are the most common cause of Cushing syndrome. While often not reported, more than 10 million people in the USA receive exogenous corticosteroids every year, and many have signs of Cushing syndrome if you actually look for it. Endogenous Cushing syndrome is actually a pretty rare disease, with a recorded incidence of 1 to 2 per 100,000 every year. All right, pop quiz time. Which hormone is responsible for most symptoms of Cushing syndrome? The answer is, of course, cortisol. Part 3. How does a patient with Cushing syndrome present? Like I mentioned, patients with Cushing syndrome can have a wide range of signs and symptoms. So let's start with the most common of these symptoms. First, centripetal obesity. While cortisol is catabolic, the mobilized macronutrients usually end up getting stored as fat, but in some pretty weird places. Patients usually have increased abdominal body fat, as well as a very characteristic pattern of fat deposition in the face and shoulders, known sometimes as moon facies and buffalo hump. I probably wouldn't tell your patients that, though. But because of muscle breakdown, the patient's extremities are usually thin, a phenomenon known as peripheral wasting. The second most common set of signs and symptoms are the skin changes. As I mentioned earlier, Cushing syndrome causes skin to become thin and easily bruised, and patients may be predisposed to cutaneous fungal infections like tinea versicolor. But the most common characteristic skin changes are striae, linear, dark stretch marks that commonly appear on the abdomen or flanks as the fragile skin stretches from the developing centripetal obesity. Additionally, increased androgen synthesis along the cortisol synthesis pathway can result in acne and hirsutism, meaning increased body hair. Finally, patients with secondary Cushing syndrome may have skin bronzing. Remember, secondary hypercortisolism is caused by high pituitary ACTH levels, and since ACTH involves the synthesis of melanocyte-stimulating hormone, these patients make more melanin. Another very common manifestation of Cushing syndrome that people don't often think of are the psychiatric changes. And these can range from mild depression and anxiety to overt mania, even psychotic symptoms. Not entirely sure what the pathophysiology is, but it definitely goes with our profile of cortisol the high-strung gunner. Sexual dysfunction and other reproductive complaints are also fairly common, especially in women. Women commonly have amenorrhea or oligomenorrhea. Men can have erectile dysfunction, and both men and women often experience decreased libido. And this isn't as intuitive, but it's likely due to suppression of gonadotropin-releasing hormone secretion by the hypothalamus, triggered by the high cortisol levels. Next, as you might imagine, the most common cardiovascular effect of Cushing syndrome is hypertension, primarily due to the enhancement of the vasoconstrictive effects of the sympathetic nervous system, but also due to increased fluid retention from cortisol's promiscuity at the mineralocorticoid receptors. Other less common cardiovascular effects include edema, accelerated atherosclerosis, and increased risk of deep venous thrombosis. Cortisol is perhaps the most famously diabetogenic hormone. Because it induces peripheral insulin resistance, the blood glucose and triglyceride levels are usually high. Now, if a patient has more prolonged or severe elevations in cortisol level, they may experience some of the less common effects, such as increased susceptibility to infection. Now, this is something most people expect, but it isn't quite as common as you might think. The infections may be routine bacterial or viral infections, but in severe cases, Cushing's patients may often get opportunistic pathogens. But a key thing to remember is that even though hypercortisolism causes immune suppression, these patients often have increased neutrophil counts when you check a CBC. It's important to remember that the rise in neutrophil count does not represent immune activation, but instead demargination of the neutrophils from the lining of blood vessels into the circulation. And this can fake out even experienced physicians, especially since a moderately elevated white count from neutrophil demargination isn't necessarily a sign of either a well-functioning immune system or systemic infection. Additionally, the catabolic effects of cortisol combine with bone and soft tissue weakness and can lead to proximal muscle weakness, osteopenia, and osteoporosis, which can all lead to easily fractured bones. Patients are also susceptible to eye disease, specifically ocular cataracts and glaucoma. So just a quick review, because I know I threw a lot at you. The most common clinical manifestation of Cushing syndrome is centripetal obesity, specifically the fat deposition pattern known as the Cushingoid body habitus. Other common effects include skin changes, psychiatric changes, sexual dysfunction, hypertension, and diabetes. Think of how gunners get when all they do is sit in a dark room all day, studying and eating potato chips for sustenance. More severe changes include susceptibility to infection, proximal muscle weakness, bone fragility, and ocular disease. All right, pop quiz just to see if you were listening. How is the blood pressure affected in patients with Cushing syndrome? The answer is, blood pressure is usually elevated. Part 4. What causes Cushing syndrome? We've already noted that the high cortisol in Cushing syndrome can be due to taking exogenous steroids or to the body's own endogenous hormone overproduction. Now we'll dig into these causes in a little bit more detail. Just to see if you remember, what's the most common cause of Cushing syndrome? By far the most common cause of Cushing syndrome is the prescribed use of glucocorticoid drugs, like prednisone. In other words, most cases of Cushing syndrome are iatrogenic, a direct result of medical treatment. This almost always comes from the high-dose, prolonged use of oral glucocorticoids to treat inflammatory or autoimmune diseases, like lupus, glomerular disease, and some forms of arthritis. And while a lot of you listening might be thinking, hey, I had to take steroids for my asthma exacerbation, how come I didn't get moon facies? Relax. Symptoms are uncommon in patients who receive short courses of oral glucocorticoids or with the use of skin creams for rashes, although to be fair, prolonged use of topical steroids can cause weakening of the underlying skin. And while you should always be on the lookout for signs of exogenous Cushing syndrome when you're prescribing long courses of steroids, we're going to spend a lot more time on endogenous causes because this is where things get interesting and a lot more complicated. To review, what are the two main categories of endogenous Cushing syndrome? Endogenous Cushing syndrome is classified based on whether the problem is with the adrenal gland itself, known as primary hypercortisolism, or from the high levels of stimulatory hormone ACTH, known as secondary hypercortisolism. Primary Cushing syndrome is much less common, but easier to conceptualize. The most frequent sources are benign adrenal adenomas, bilateral adrenal hyperplasia, or in rare cases, adrenal carcinoma. Secondary Cushing syndrome actually makes up about 90% of cases of endogenous Cushing's. The most intuitive cause of secondary Cushing syndrome is from a hyperfunctioning pituitary gland. The hypersecretion of ACTH is what causes the adrenal glands to secrete more cortisol. In these cases, you can have a pituitary adenoma, or less commonly, generalized corticotroph hyperplasia. And it's important to note that pituitary adenomas don't have to be large to cause Cushing syndrome. In fact, 90% of tumors are less than a centimeter in diameter and are classified as microadenomas. But another important cause of secondary Cushing syndrome comes from cancer cells. Not pituitary cancer. Poorly differentiated neuroendocrine cells of multiple lineages can mutate to unlock the latent ability to secrete ACTH. The most common types of cancer that can secrete ACTH are carcinoid tumors of the lungs, thymus, and pancreas, advanced small cell lung cancer, and medullary thyroid cancer. Two buzzwords you're going to want to remember. If the ACTH is being secreted from somewhere besides the pituitary, it's called ectopic production. The second buzzword is that the Cushing syndrome you get from these types of cancer is called a paraneoplastic syndrome by oncologists, which is a cancer-related problem that's not caused by a tumor directly invading, compressing, or destroying nearby tissue. All right, time to check in, gang. What is the most common cause of endogenous Cushing syndrome? The answer is ACTH secretion by a pituitary adenoma. Part 5. How is Cushing syndrome diagnosed? The first step in diagnosis is to actually recognize Cushing syndrome, which can be challenging because a lot of its signs and symptoms are similar to those found in other conditions. All right, now put on your clinician thinking hats. If you suspect Cushing syndrome and you only get one question to ask your patient, what should that question be? By far the most important question to ask is, do you take steroids? Prednisone, methylprednisolone, dexamethasone, something else that ends with "-one. It's the most common cause of Cushing syndrome, so that one's a gimme. But if you need lab testing, in a patient with exogenous Cushing's, the measured serum ACTH should be low, since exogenous steroids also suppress the pituitary gland by feedback suppression. But once exogenous Cushing's is excluded, lab tests are used to both confirm endogenous Cushing syndrome and identify its cause. The first step is to prove the patient actually has elevated endogenous cortisol using one of three tests. There's the 24-hour urine-free cortisol, which basically involves collecting a whole day's worth of the patient's pee, which is not convenient and kind of gross. If you want a more convenient test, there's a late-night salivary cortisol measurement. Note that a random cortisol level is not useful because of its diurnal variation, so it's got to be a late-night cortisol level. Finally, you can use a low-dose dexamethasone suppression test. We'll talk about the dexamethasone suppression test a bit later, but the important thing to remember here is that you need at least one, often two of these tests, to actually confirm that the patient has elevated serum cortisol and didn't just gain all that weight and become depressed because they were stuck in their room all day eating Cheetos. Now, if you understand the basics of endocrine physiology, you can figure this one out pretty easily. After you confirm the diagnosis of Cushing syndrome with a cortisol level, what lab value do you need to measure to determine whether you're dealing with primary versus secondary hypercortisolism? You measure the serum ACTH level. A high level suggests secondary hypercortisolism, which, remember, is more common. A low level suggests primary adrenal overproduction of cortisol. Remember your negative feedback loops. If the pituitary is working normally, the high levels of cortisol will negatively feed back on the pituitary, and it should lower the ACTH levels. So just to review, a basic history tells you if the person might have Cushing syndrome from exogenous corticosteroids. A cortisol level either from a 24-hour urine or a late-night salivary cortisol confirms that the person actually has endogenous Cushing syndrome. And a serum ACTH level helps distinguish primary from secondary Cushing's. Got it? Okay, good. Because now we're going to hit the dexamethasone suppression tests, one of the most important tests in the workup of endogenous Cushing syndrome. The dexamethasone suppression test is conceptually simple. Dexamethasone is an exogenous steroid that's treated like cortisol by the body, but doesn't register as cortisol on any of your lab tests. Now, this requires some audience participation, so get ready to do some thinking. If you give a normal person dexamethasone, what do you predict will happen to their ACTH levels? Since the cells of the anterior pituitary treat dexamethasone like cortisol, they assume the body has more than enough cortisol and decrease secretion of ACTH by normal negative feedback. And what's going to happen to the body's own endogenous synthesis of cortisol? Lower ACTH means lower endogenous cortisol synthesis. As the name suggests, administration of dexamethasone should suppress endogenous synthesis of both ACTH and cortisol. Should make sense if you know your negative feedback loops. Now, there's two flavors of the dexamethasone suppression test, low dose and high dose. That's 1 milligram for the low dose and 8 milligrams of the high dose, if you care. Now, in a normal patient, even a low dose of dexamethasone should suppress endogenous ACTH and cortisol synthesis. But any patient with Cushing syndrome will be used to way higher levels of glucocorticoids in their body, and 1 milligram of dexamethasone is basically nothing to them. So, low-dose dexamethasone will fail to suppress endogenous ACTH and cortisol synthesis in a patient with Cushing syndrome. That's why it's used as one of the three confirmatory tests to determine whether or not a patient has Cushing's. The high-dose dexamethasone suppression test is used to distinguish between different causes of secondary Cushing syndrome. Remind me again, what two lab tests tell you if your patient has secondary Cushing's? You need an elevated cortisol level by one of three methods and an elevated ACTH level, right? But once you know you're dealing with secondary Cushing's, the most important distinction is to determine whether the source of high ACTH is the pituitary gland or an ectopic cancer. Now, here's the thing. Even if you have a pituitary adenoma or hyperplasia, those cells are all still corticotrophs. That means they're equipped with all the normal mechanisms for feedback suppression, but since there's so many of them, they end up secreting way too much ACTH. With a high enough dose of dexamethasone, you'll still be able to suppress those pituitary cells. But a cancer cell that mutates the ability to secrete ACTH doesn't automatically mutate its entire feedback regulatory pathway. That secretion is totally abnormal. So, no matter how much dexamethasone you administer, you'll never suppress ACTH or cortisol levels in a patient with paraneoplastic Cushing syndrome. A corticotropin-releasing hormone, or CRH stimulation test, can be used to confirm the high-dose dexamethasone suppression test. It's basically the opposite of the dexamethasone suppression test. CRH causes release of ACTH from the anterior pituitary. If administration of CRH leads to higher ACTH and cortisol levels, it suggests a pituitary source of hypercortisolism. Failure to stimulate higher ACTH and cortisol suggests an ectopic ACTH source, like cancer. Now let's be real. Nobody's just going to order lab tests, diagnose secondary Cushing's disease, and then blindly operate on someone's pituitary gland just because the high-dose dexamethasone suppression test said so. You definitely need imaging. But since full-body CT scans are generally frowned upon because, you know, cancer, the lab tests help tell you where to look. If you suspect a patient has primary Cushing syndrome, you need a CT or an MRI of the abdomen to assess the adrenal gland. This will also help differentiate adenomas from adrenal hyperplasia. If you suspect secondary Cushing syndrome or Cushing disease, do a pituitary MRI to look for tumors. And finally, if an ectopic ACTH source is suspected, do a chest and abdominal CT scan to look for lung cancer, carcinoid tumors, or other possible ectopic sources of ACTH. Part 6. How is Cushing syndrome treated? The treatment of Cushing syndrome depends on the cause. To address the elephant in the room, if a patient has Cushing syndrome because of a steroid you gave them, well, then obviously the solution is to stop the medication. But it's not so simple. Glucocorticoids are therapeutically administered for some pretty important reasons, like to prevent transplant rejection as part of chemotherapy regimens, and to treat crippling or life-threatening autoimmune diseases. Personally, I'll take the buffalo hump if it means my transplant kidney won't fail on me. But try to lower the glucocorticoid dose if possible. And if a patient needs maintenance glucocorticoids, use the lowest dose possible. Remember that the drug should be tapered off, not stopped abruptly, to avoid acute adrenal insufficiency. Both pituitary and adrenal adenomas can be surgically resected, the former using a pretty nifty endoscopic approach through the patient's nose, called a transsphenoidal pituitary resection. Bilateral adrenal hyperplasia is treated medically with drugs that inhibit the synthesis of cortisol, such as metirapone, ketoconazole, and mitotane. And finally, ectopic cancers are located and treated surgically or with chemotherapy, depending on the cancer. The cortisol-reducing drugs can be used in cancer for unresectable metastatic disease in order to palliatively lower cortisol levels. And that's a wrap on Cushing syndrome. Let's review and see what you learned. First, what is the hormone abnormality that defines Cushing syndrome? The answer is an excess of glucocorticoids. Next, name five of the most common clinical manifestations of Cushing syndrome. The most common clinical manifestations of Cushing syndrome are the Cushingoid habitus, namely central obesity and unusual fat deposits in the face and shoulders. There's also skin changes, like striae, psychiatric changes, which everyone forgets about, sexual dysfunction, hypertension, and diabetes. Third, what is the most common cause of Cushing syndrome? The most common cause of Cushing syndrome is exogenous use of pharmacologic glucocorticoid drugs like prednisone. The most common endogenous cause is from pituitary hypersecretion of ACTH, otherwise known as secondary Cushing syndrome or Cushing's disease. Finally, and this may take some thinking, so pause the audio if you need to, describe the diagnostic pathway that helps distinguish between the different causes of endogenous Cushing syndrome. The first step is to confirm that a patient actually has Cushing syndrome by measuring a cortisol level in one of three ways: 24-hour urine cortisol, late-night salivary cortisol, or a low-dose dexamethasone suppression test. Next, serum ACTH is used to distinguish between primary and secondary Cushing syndrome. Finally, the high-dose dexamethasone suppression test and CRH stimulation test distinguish between pituitary and ectopic sources of secondary Cushing syndrome. Any more specific than that, and you're going to need imaging studies. Now, armed with your newfound knowledge, let's get back to that patient from the intro. A 52-year-old female presents to your clinic with what you suspect is Cushing syndrome secondary to prednisone use. What do you suspect the patient's cortisol and ACTH levels will look like? And how do you plan to manage the patient's condition if your suspicions are confirmed? Pause the video if you need some time to think. Based on the history alone, you suspect that the patient has Cushing syndrome caused by taking exogenous steroids. And unsurprisingly, her 24-hour urinary cortisol and serum ACTH levels come back low. You suggest she speak with her nephrologist about slowly tapering her prednisone to the minimum dose needed to manage what you now suspect is lupus nephritis. And she admits that her nephrologist did instruct her to do that. "But I was feeling so much better on it, I just kept taking the higher dose." She's grateful, however, that you correctly identified her symptoms as a medication side effect and promises to taper her prednisone as instructed. And that's it for our show. Remember, don't be a high-strung gunner. Make sure to like and subscribe on Apple Podcasts if you like what you hear. Remember, your feedback helps us improve. You can enjoy the full BRICS experience online at www.usmle-rx.com, complete with illustrations, questions, flashcards, and active learning. So go check that out if you haven't already. Until next time, friends.